Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. As a longtime reporter at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, Mary Frost is in touch with her readers a lot. This is a community newspaper, after all.
So we get a lot of community participation. People call us up. They complain about things.
People share problems they want to see addressed, especially noise in the city.
Because this is Brooklyn.
Case in point, you're hearing sirens in the background. There are also loud garbage trucks, construction sites, neighbors blaring music, even a mystery screeching sound that turned out to be wind blowing through defective balcony railings. But the complaint Mary got last November from a reader named Victoria Owens seemed different. Frantic.
There was something about the noise complaint that sounded just so desperate. And she was like, please, please, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't do my work.
The caller described the noise as a shrill, high-pitched alarm. It was going 24/7 and seemed to be centered in Brooklyn Heights, but no one could find the source. And more than anything, what made the noise stand out to Mary was the effect it seemed to have.
This sound was driving people oddly crazy. Fights were breaking out.
People accusing each other. This is coming from your building.
Every once in a while, you would just find random people standing on street corners looking up to try to figure out where the sound was coming from. And I realized this was turning into a whole neighborhood sort of quest to find out what this noise was.
We're always surrounded by sound, but when it gets annoying or too loud, we tend to call it noise. And actually, we're pretty good at tuning out noises. This is how physicist Helen Chersky put it when we talked to her about sound last week.
Quite a lot of the time, without us being conscious of it, our brain is filtering things out. So perhaps there's a fan that you have on in your office every day. Well, your brain will hear it for a bit, and then your consciousness will stop noticing it.
But some noises are just too loud or too grating to tune out, like a car alarm going off in the middle of the night or the neighbor's dog barking early in the morning. They make it impossible to sleep, hard to concentrate, or to have a conversation. How does that affect our well-being and health? Today's episode is the second part of our exploration of sound, and it's all about noise and the quest to reduce its irritating presence in our lives. So let's investigate that shrill and persistent mystery noise that stumped neighbors in Brooklyn. Liz Tong looked into what happened next.
Wilson Burroughs loves living in Brooklyn Heights.
It's really, really beautiful. It's right along the water.
Affluent but not flashy. The kind of place that draws in young professional families.
And it very much feels like a neighborhood. It's not very loud. There's not a lot of traffic. And it's like a very old historic neighborhood. So it's kind of like, I would almost describe it like perfect, but I'm biased because I live there.
Perfect until one day last November, when Wilson first noticed the sound.
So I work from home, and I had gone into like my like living space, and I heard a noise, and I was like, where is that coming from? Is it coming from inside my apartment? Like, is it coming from the heater?
Eventually, Wilson headed outside to investigate. She stood on the corner in front of the grocery store and listened.
And it was so loud, and I was like, what? I was baffled because I didn't understand why everyone else wasn't like looking up, being like, what is this noise? This strange noise.
Wilson headed inside the grocery store to see if anyone knew what it was. They had no idea what she was talking about.
I asked one of my neighbors in the elevator, I was like, Do you hear that noise? And she was like, there's a lot of noise in New York, like just close your window. And I was like, I think I'm going insane.
She called in reports to 311. even contacted her local police precinct. Nobody could help. Finally, out of desperation, Wilson started a TikTok account devoted to the sound. She called it the Buzz BK Heights.
And I was like, maybe if I make a TikTok about the noise, someone will be like, I've heard that noise. I know what it is.
Here's the video she posted.
It didn't work.
It wasn't until Wilson logged onto the social networking site next door that she realized there were other people who heard and hated the sound.
I would equate it to like a chirping sound.
This is Victoria Owens. She's a young mom who lives in the neighborhood. She's the one who emailed Mary Frost, the Brooklyn Eagle reporter, about the sound. By that time, she was more than a week into her investigation and deeply obsessed.
What's important to know about it is it's not terribly loud. The volume wasn't really the offensive part. It was more the pitch and the frequency. So it was just 24/7. You would wake up. It was there. It was in every room of your house. It was when you're watching TV at night, you can hear it. Once you hear it too, you can't stop. It's like your brain locks into it and you hear it over everything and it just gets in there.
Victoria started out just walking around the neighborhood, asking other people if they could hear that annoying sound. Some could, some couldn't. Some said they thought it was birds, or that it was the air conditioner from the grocery store on the corner, or that it was coming from a nearby construction site. She even stopped by a few apartment buildings to talk to the doormen. They all said the same thing.
I don't know, you know, it's probably coming from, and they would point across the street to a different offending building.
Victoria reported her findings, or her lack of findings, back to the next door page. Turned out Wilson hadn't been having any luck either, so the two of them decided to team up. And soon, they found someone who actually seemed to care.
I think somebody in the neighborhood texted me or emailed me and said, I know this isn't necessarily what you all do, but can you help?
This is Laura Birnbach. She's head of the Brooklyn Heights Association, a neighborhood group that, as it happens, has very good connections with city agencies. So Laura started working the phones.
The city agencies that I contacted were DEP, DOT, Department of Transportation, because they have jurisdiction over the street lights, the MTA, the supers of both the Cadman Towers, and then I had also contacted our incoming city council member.
In the meantime, Mary Frost, the Brooklyn Eagle reporter, was keeping tabs on the investigation, along with the evolving list of suspects that could be the source of the terrible noise.
An MTA construction trailer, a streetlight fixture, the neon sign above Gristiti's, the parking garage, scaffolding, Plymouth Cafe, unspecified, and something on the roof of the Clark Street subway station. Those were all the suspects.
With the help of various city agencies, Laura ruled them out one by one. By this time, it wasn't just Laura, Victoria, and Wilson on the case. Just about the whole neighborhood had been sucked into the drama. Everyone had ideas about what the sound was and where it was coming from. Mary told me one building manager just about lost it after she became overwhelmed with complaints from neighbors who were convinced her building was the culprit.
There were angry people invading the office and a fight almost broke out and the police were almost called.
They'd now been living with the mystery noise for more than 2 weeks, and Wilson was starting to lose it.
I definitely felt like emotionally like just frayed because I couldn't, you can't really relax. Because it's always there and it's driving me insane because I don't feel like it's ever going to turn off.
Victoria was also nearing the end of her rope.
It was really chipping away at my sanity because I wasn't sleeping and I would like put a pillow around my head and I could still hear it. And I started to panic that this would be like the new soundtrack of our lives. And that was like really scary to sort of grapple with. I was like, will we have to move? Will we have to sell the house? I mean, that's how, like, crazy we were getting.
This is one of the things that fascinated me about this story, is how crazy the sound was making people. I wanted to know what exactly it was that made this sound so irritating, so painful, so torturous to so many people. To find out, I talked with Luc Arnal, a neuroscientist who studies how we perceive sound. I started off by giving him a taste of the mystery noise.
Have you ever heard a sound like that before? Well, that sound is very weird.
Luke studies aversive sounds, basically sounds that people hate, and how exactly they trigger negative emotions.
And I think the two main features that are used in this alarm specifically are intensity. I think the intensity is super, super high. And also the high pitch. Those are the two most painful.
Both of which are common features of two aversive sounds that Luke studies, alarms and babies crying. Luke's research uses brain scans to find out how and why these sounds provoke such a strong reaction.
And we observed that those sounds, they have the capacity to reach very deep parts of our brain that are involved in emotional reactions and processing. There is no way you can avoid these sounds. There is no mechanism, apparently, to suppress these sounds. You have to process them, and this is how they control our brains.
What makes things worse is that the same brain circuits that process these sounds are also connected with sleep. And as any new parent can tell you, anything that stops you from sleeping can have serious effects on your well-being.
And I think those sounds, if you're exposed to those sounds, it can have like really, really detrimental effects on your like mental health.
And not just your mental health. Psychiatrist Matthias Basner studies how unwanted noise negatively affects us from top to bottom.
Increases in heart rate, excretion of stress hormones like adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol that drive immediate responses, you know, like a fight or flight response.
Matthias says one recent study showed that unwanted noise activates the amygdala, the part of the brain responsible for processing emotions.
This emotional activation is also driving inflammation. And the same subjects were more likely to develop cardiovascular disease in the long run.
Matthias says you don't even have to consciously perceive noise for it to affect your health. Whether we notice it or not, it's still triggering the same physiological responses and disrupting our sleep. Over the long term, that cascade of effects can have some serious health consequences, like elevated risk of heart attack or stroke. And not only that.
The inflammation also, you know, could explain why we have first studies now showing that a noise can drive obesity, cancer, perhaps autoimmune diseases. I mean, that research is only emerging, but it makes a lot of sense that noise can have these negative health consequences on a broad spectrum of diseases, not only cardiovascular disease.
I have to say, after talking to Luke and Matthias, the way people in Brooklyn Heights were reacting to the sound made a lot more sense. Luckily, about 2 weeks into the mystery sound, which as a reminder had been blaring 24/7, the man who would become Brooklyn Heights' savior showed up, Toba Petusky.
I had not been experiencing to the extent that everybody else had been plagued by this. I just wanted to help.
Toba has lived in the neighborhood for almost 40 years, and he's known as the go-to guy when people need help. So even though he hadn't really noticed the sound, when neighbors reached out, he jumped into action. Toba started off like just about everyone else had, walking around the neighborhood trying to pinpoint the source of the sound.
It sounded like it was coming from the St. George Hotel.
Toba stopped there and listened.
And then it seemed like it was coming from a different direction.
So Toba walked another 10 minutes in that direction, till he got to a little shop called Peas and Pickles. But once he got there,
it sounded then it was coming across the street from the deli. But whatever direction that I went to, it always seemed it was coming from the opposite location.
Toba spent the next week like this, hunting the sound from block to block, gathering clues from frustrated supers and irate business owners. But still, nothing turned up.
It was just impossible. It was just absolutely impossible. And then the remarkable thing happened.
Here, I'm going to let Mary, the Brooklyn Eagle reporter, tell what happened next.
His wife, Ronnie, made a spectacular leap of intuition.
I was home. I think maybe it was approximately 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And my wife texted me that she was on her way home.
A few minutes later, he heard her in the hallway fumbling with her keys, but for some reason, not coming in. So Toba stepped into the hallway.
Ronnie's fateful words were, "What's that sound?" And then the whole thing just started falling into place.
Ronnie thought the sound was coming from their building, their neighbor's apartment, to be precise. But Toba wasn't convinced.
I said, no, that apartment is actually facing in the direction where the sound is coming from.
Besides, to Toba, it didn't sound any louder in their hallway than it did anywhere else. He called their neighbor. He had been on vacation for a couple weeks. No answer. So Toba and Ronnie decided to go for it. They fished out their spare key, called the super for the big moment, and then the three of them went in.
And as soon as we walked into the apartment, the sound was blaring. It was just blaring.
They'd finally found the source of their misery. And this is what it sounded like up close.
And I thought, what is going on? And so I went out to the terrace, and there it was, this box, maybe like a 6-inch by 6-inch square.
They took a picture, which they later sent to Brooklyn Eagle reporter Mary.
It turned out to be a Bird X Transonic Pro small animal repeller system, sold for $35.49 at Target.
A pest repeller, designed to keep bugs and rodents away. A flurry of calls and texts went out between Toba, the super, and Victoria, announcing the big news. Victoria texted Wilson, and both of them listened in live as Toba pulled the plug.
And when Toba turned it off, it was like a peace settled over the neighborhood.
Here's Victoria.
There was such like a thrill in this discovery. I mean, the adrenaline, the happiness, I was ecstatic. Couldn't believe it. It was like unfolding in real time and we were part of it. And I remember being so, just could not believe that it was going to stop, that we were going to have quiet.
Wilson watched from her balcony.
I think I definitely cried because, 17 days is a really long time.
They got a few precious moments of silence. And then Toba's phone rang.
It was my neighbor. He said, what's going on? And I said, I'm in your apartment. You have this box that's blasting out the neighborhood. And he said, that's to stop the pigeons from flying on my terrace. And I said, you're destroying the neighborhood. It's the first thing that came to my mind. And he said, I'll be clean about it. He said, BS. And I said, no BS. I'm in your apartment right now, and I just disconnected this box. He said, how bad was it? I go, it is bad.
Toba ended up not naming the neighbor for Mary Frost's article. He said the guy felt bad enough. Plus, Toba told me he was an older guy.
Well, I guess when you're older, your hearing isn't what it used to be. So, kind of makes sense.
No. You're standing next to a loudspeaker that's blaring. I don't care how old you are. It's unexplainable. It's unexplainable.
Kind of makes you wonder why anyone would want or even make such a device. I posed that question to the manufacturers, BirdX, and they told me a couple things. For one, this specific device was not made for keeping pigeons away, and also not made for balconies. It's designed for indoor use, for sticking in some remote shed to keep away bugs and rodents. It was all just an accident. A really, really annoying accident. But everyone I talked to had some moral to draw from the story. For Victoria, it was the impact of noise on her well-being.
How it affects the body, like cognitively, emotionally, mentally. It was interesting.
For Wilson, it was the danger of pest repellers.
I like feel like it should have been like a PSA to like all city dwellers. Like, this is what a bird alarm sounds like. And like, it's not okay to put one out. It should be illegal in a city setting.
And for Mary, it was the good that came out of it.
In the long run, being able to solve this drew the community together. People are friends now who weren't friends before. And so it was sort of a feel-good story, too.
In fact, Wilson and Victoria said something similar. They're good friends now, and they never would have met if it weren't for the mystery sound.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. Special thanks to Mary Frost from the Brooklyn Eagle. We'll link to her reporting on our website. We're talking about noise, and we wanted to hear from you. What are the noises that really bother you? Here's Heather Irvin.
My children are 4.5 and 2 years old, and they have a way of shrieking so loudly, so piercing, that you see red, you lose your hearing, your ears actually hurt. And when one does it, the other one follows, and it becomes a cycle that you really can't stop.
We also got this one.
Hi, This is Michelle Squisamara, and I am the registrar at the Stoogeum, the world's first and largest museum dedicated to the Three Stooges. We are located just outside of Philadelphia in Lower Gwynedd. Our introductory exhibit has an arcade-like atmosphere. One of these displays is an interactive trivia game. When the game idles, it plays three blind mice until the next player approaches. Sometimes it's 10 seconds, sometimes it's more like a minute, sometimes it's like 5 minutes of three blind mice over and over and over again. It's the kind of loud that you can hear through a flight of stairs and two closed doors. When the exhibits are powered down, you used to have to be careful not to walk too close to it, or three blind mice would blare into pitch darkness.
We always love to hear from you. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at WHYY The Pulse to stay in touch. Coming up, a look at alarms in hospitals. They are loud, they make patients anxious, and most of them go off without serious cause.
99% of the alarms that we saw were not actionable.
That's next on The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about noise, how it affects us, and how we can reduce it. The beeping of monitors is the ever-present audio wallpaper of hospital units. Medical devices monitoring patients send off alerts when something is not quite right. Heart rate is off, beep, pulse low, beep, beep, ventilator seems to be malfunctioning, another alarm. Nurses are haunted by them in their sleep.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
For patients, they can be terrifying.
I can still hear that alarm today, and even when I just think about it, it gets my blood pumping, and it gets the anxiety levels up.
But the thing is, the vast majority of these alarms are unnecessary. A few years ago, I talked to Chris Bonafide, a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
99% of the alarms that we saw were not actionable, meaning that a true alarm, an alarm that you really needed to run in the door and save a patient, was truly like a needle in a haystack, like a 1% kind of a thing.
The 99% figure he mentioned applies to regular hospital units, but even in an intensive care setting, the vast majority of alarms do not mean a patient is in danger.
We're living in a world now where it doesn't make sense to monitor every single patient in the hospital.
So let's take a listen back to the reporting on hospital alarms that I did back in 2015, and then we'll hear an update on this research. 3-1. Many patients at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia are hooked up to monitors and machines with wires and stickers with sensors. Let's say the patient is an energetic baby kicking his legs and the sticker comes off.
So the device on the wall thinks that his heart rate is going way out of whack, but actually it's just fine and it's a happy kicking baby with a slightly loose kind of a lead.
Chris Bonafide has been studying what happens when healthcare workers get one false alarm after another. They get desensitized. Alarms don't feel urgent anymore. They fade into the background. This phenomenon is called alarm fatigue.
So when you hear this, you think...
I think it's probably nothing.
It's probably nothing. That's something Mike Kennedy and his wife Christine heard a lot when their son Alex was in the NICU at another hospital.
Your child is in a glass box hooked up to every conceivable kind of monitor, and you just don't know what's going on. It's frightening.
Alex was a tiny preemie, born just 27 weeks into the pregnancy. To Mike and Christine, the alarms sounded urgent.
Like a team of doctors should be rushing in to take care of the situation.
They felt like the nurses were often taking too long to come and check on Alex. One day, the pulse ox alarm went off, and when Mike and Christine looked up to the monitor...
we just saw the oxygen level going down rapidly, and it got down below 30%, and it was scary, and we could see coming out of his mouth and nose was formula, so It was clear that he was choking on the formula that he was being fed, and it was preventing him from getting oxygen. And so we called over the nurses, and they were like, oh, it's okay, he'll be fine. And we're like, no, it's not fine. Something's going on here. We need you to get over here and take a look. And we eventually did get their attention, and they came over, and they're like, oh, whoa, it is something here. And they took care of it, and everything was fine. But, you know, for weeks after that, I kept thinking, what are the ramifications of this?
The incident deeply affected Mike, making him feel like he needed to be on guard at all times. He says the sound of those alarms haunts him to this day, years later, even though his son is a healthy kid now. Too many false alarms slow down response times. That's something Chris Bonafide learned when he tracked how quickly nurses responded when they had already received lots of alarms during their shift.
As you got up to the most extreme group, the group of nurses who had seen 80 or more alarms in the preceding 2 hours, their response time was several fold slower to future alarms when they had been exposed to that many alarms. So we thought that was pretty consistent with alarm fatigue.
How slow is slow?
We're talking difference of minutes.
Alarms becoming audio wallpaper is not a new problem. People started talking about it in the 1980s when patient monitoring became much more high-tech. At the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Chris says over 1,800 different devices are used in patient care, and most of them can send off alarms. And every time one of them goes off, a nurse on the floor is alerted and has to make a decision.
Do I stop and interrupt this task that is probably really important to go and check on that other patient? So it's a difficult decision happening for a nurse. It can happen hundreds of times just in a single shift.
You may be calculating your medication dose and drawing up your meds, and your alarm beeps. You turn around to look at your phone or to look at your patient.
That's Children's Hospital Intensive Care Unit nurse Kara Tarady.
And then to being able to start that process all over again and not just pick up in the middle, so you lessen the gap for error.
So basically, once you've interrupted, you go back to square one?
Correct.
So that sounds frustrating.
It can be. It can be very frustrating. I think it's something that we've just become accustomed to in the ICU.
So that's what I learned about hospital alarms and alarm fatigue in 2015, and I wanted to check back in with Chris Bonafide to see what had happened since then.
Yeah, so when we last spoke, we were really doing a lot of foundational research work that we needed to do.
For example, they got a better sense of just how often alarms were going off.
On a regular floor, a patient might have between 50 and 150 alarms per day. In the ICUs, a patient might have 300 or even 500 alarms per patient per day. So we were in a system where it would be difficult to conceive how an individual person could respond to every single alarm that was occurring.
How was that affecting patient care and overall safety? Chris started a patient safety learning lab to first gather data and then come up with solutions. Making the system better involved changing the settings on some of the alarms to go off a little later.
So, for example, allows the heart rate to creep up a little bit more before it generates an alarm. What that can do, the net effect of that, is to create a system that is safer but has fewer alarms because those individual alarms are more meaningful. They are alarms that are unequivocally alarms that warrant someone to go to that bedside right away and pay attention to that patient.
Megan McNamara was part of the team to make the changes. She's a nurse and a safety quality specialist at the Children's Hospital.
The challenge to us was to be bold, and I think that we really were. We expanded some of our defaults. We eliminated some alarms that really aren't a value add to nurses, such as, you know, respiratory rate high. That is an alarm that's often non-actionable. And so we basically eliminated that from our settings.
So these are settings that can be changed that cut down, it sounds to me, some of the noise. So like my iPhone tells me all the time that my iPhone storage is almost full and it's this little red thing, but it doesn't really mean anything. So can I imagine it a little bit like this?
It's sort of like telling your iPhone if it's telling you that at 95% of your storage, it's sort of like saying, you know what, I don't want to know until it's at 98% of my storage is full.
They initially implemented these changes in one hospital unit and monitored everything very carefully. And then this month, the entire hospital system adopted the new settings. Chris has some preliminary data.
The easiest number to look at is what happened to the number of alarms. And what we saw there was about a 75% reduction in alarms from just about 150 alarms down to the mid-30s of alarms. So a really big reduction in the absolute number of alarms without any increase in patient safety events. In essence, assuring that the safety is at least as good as it was before and ideally and hopefully better. And we'll learn that with time.
They also did another survey of the nurses asking about alarm fatigue. Here's Megan.
They are so excited about the changes. It's quiet on the unit are things I hear. Like, thank you for our frontline nurses. That this is one less thing that is adding to the stress and anxiety of their day.
Chris says in general, the hospital is quieter now. For example, the changes had a big impact in the infant transitional care unit.
That unit used to, you would walk onto that unit and you would be barraged with alarms. And now when you walk into that unit, it's much quieter. It's not completely without alarms, but it's a more peaceful space. And I hope that for patients and families, it's a more, it's a space that is more conducive to healing and recovery.
So that's one effort to reduce the noise in hospitals and make alarms more meaningful. Joseph Schlesinger is also working on this issue. He wants to change hospital alarms in a way that they convey more specific information. Joseph is an anesthesiologist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville and also a musician. So he brings his musical training to the clinical environment. He's worked on a series of hospital alarms that he calls auditory icons.
Think about you're using your computer and you delete something, it's in the recycle bin, you empty the recycle bin, you get that crumpling paper sound.
Mm-hmm. Whoosh.
Yeah. And so everyone kind of has that sense of, okay, I threw something away, I deleted it, I crumpled it. And so that's an auditory icon. It has meaning in sound. So what we've done is we've taken the classic categories of sounds and made auditory icons to communicate what's wrong. So to give an example, for a cardiovascular alarm, we've embedded a lub-dub sound like a beating heart. So when you hear an alarm and you hear that lub-dub, you know it's a cardiovascular problem. So then when you're looking at the patient monitor, instead of having to scan around and figure out which number is having an issue from a physiologic parameter, you're primed to know. That one was the one that has that lub-dub sound.
Okay, so that's a heart that shows me if I'm a nurse or a physician, it's like, okay, there's a heart involved here.
Exactly. So it could be heart rate or blood pressure. And we're doing further designs to be even more communicative. That is it heart rate? Is it blood pressure? Is it high? Is it low? But we started with these base sounds, these foundations. But even starting out, we've shown that this new auditory icon has great benefit.
That's Joseph Schlesinger. He's an anesthesiologist at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. The hospital alarms he's designed are available for free online. We'll post a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up, we'll follow a sound detective who tracks noise for a living.
Apartment 2C, living room, sound coming through floor and walls, mostly floor.
That's next on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about noise, how it affects us and how we can reduce it. We heard from a lot of people about noises that bother them. Here's one from Brady Dale about the soundtrack of summer, ice cream trucks.
One night when it was already hot and I didn't have an air conditioner and was already having a really rough time sleeping or feeling comfortable or anything in my apartment, one of those ice cream trucks just stopped on the corner outside of my apartment and played, I'm pretty sure it was Do Your Ears Hang Low on its little speakers, just over and over and over again. And I think, you know, it was one of those ice cream trucks that at the end of like whatever its song was had like a little like yippee sound to show that they'd reached the end, and then it just repeated. So like every time that little yippee sound hit, it was just like, oh, the fresh hell is beginning again. And it was just, it just played for so long and I had nothing to shut it out. It was completely insanity making.
When you live in a city and really close to your neighbors, noise is pretty much always a presence. Somebody is playing loud music, a baby is crying, traffic is nearby, people are yelling and carrying on. Jad Slaman spent a day in New York City, probably one of the louder places on earth, and he followed an acoustical consultant who makes a living finding and eliminating noise.
Walking around New York City with an acoustic consultant, I notice all the noise I never noticed before when I lived here. Alan Firestein is moving from job to job, stopping here and there to point out an especially loud or obnoxious sound, like this produce truck.
Refrigeration in that truck is illegally loud, by the way.
Oh, yeah? People hire Al to find out how much noise is getting into spaces and how, especially when there's a legal dispute over noise. Al knows the New York City noise codes like a preacher knows the Bible. What frequencies can hit what decibel and in what context? He spends as much time in court as in the field explaining his readings and why they mean that a club, a concert hall, or grocery truck is so loud it's breaking the law.
Okay, so this would be the northwest corner.
Al's first job of the day is in the nicest apartment I've ever visited. It's a loft, technically, in Soho, with high ceilings, two expensive-looking pianos, and a private home recording studio. The owner is a musician of some kind, a rich and famous one. I don't recognize him, and I'm kind of afraid to ask who he is. In any case, Al agreed to let me tag along with him if I didn't identify his clients. That muffled techno is coming from an enormous speaker Al set up downstairs. Al is taking all these readings because a retail clothing store is going to be opening up soon downstairs. He wants to know how much sound gets into the loft and how it's getting in there so that the co-op that runs the building can set rules about music in the store. I watch as Al lays first on the floor, head flat against the hardwood. He then gets up and puts an ear to an interior brick wall painted white. Finally, he makes his way over to an exposed wooden support beam, a holdover from when this place was a factory. There, he motions for me to come join him.
You hear on this?
Yeah, I was just about
to... You hear the mid-range?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's wild.
My microphone can't pick it up, but if I put my head right up against the wooden beam, my ears completely flush against it, I hear the melody of the song.
So it's the bass is coming through the floor and a bit of the melody, these beams.
Al makes recordings of all this stuff using a specialized calibrated audio spectrum recorder that breaks down what amount of sound is coming in at what frequencies.
The frequencies that are the loudest
looks
are
like
between
six...
50 and 100 hertz.
Uh-huh.
Right now the cursor is on 80.
He explains different parts of the music move through different parts of the building's materials. For example, the wooden support beam that carries the melody.
Actual wood?
The wood is not strong enough. It's not massive enough to stop mid-range frequencies from getting into it.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets into it and it carries up. Brick is, on the other hand, very stiff and massive. It's hard for anything to get in. Probably the mid-range is the easiest for it to get in, but each layer of mortar dampens out the sound. So going up, it reduces. Coming through the side, loud bass would be heard on the outside of the building.
If you listen to the brick walls of the building from the outside, you do hear music because there's only one or two layers of brick between you and the speaker. But if you listen to the brick wall from the upstairs apartment, it's silent. Because the wall, while only a couple bricks wide, is dozens of bricks tall. That's too much for sound to get through. Sound moves in somewhat surprising ways. It's part of what makes Al's services so in demand. This is the first of non-stop calls he'll take today. Wherever we are, whatever Al says goes. At a later stop at this upscale club, he had the owner cut out what seemed like a half dozen holes in their walls so he could see what was going on behind him.
The next thing I want to know is what's behind this wall.
Visiting this musician's loft in Soho, though, is a proactive step meant to avoid all that. An ugly noise battle down the line. Disputes over things like this break out all the time in New York City, and especially Manhattan, where countless homes and studios, businesses and schools are built basically right on top of each other. These fights are usually pretty ugly and always expensive.
Yeah, well, usually it's a war, it's a big lawsuit.
Al has many tales. There was the TV studio that interviewed whatever celebrity of the day that was built right below a gym. The gym owner thought rubber pads would be enough. They weren't.
Because you drop a 130 or 180 pound barbell, it sounds like a boom downstairs.
Today, Al gives the musician some recommendations. The noise from the retail store shouldn't go above this level. The speakers should be hung instead of mounted. He'll come up with a detailed report later. In the meantime, we roll off to our next job, literally. Al drags this huge speaker behind him on a handcart. We walk in the street as often as the sidewalk because there's just no room for the three of us. We keep moving, and I keep asking questions while that speaker is mercifully turned off.
There, so how did you first get into this line of work?
How did I get into it? Well, it's a long story.
He got his start in music. He was always an electronics guy, tinkering with this and that, and soon found himself doing maintenance at recording studios.
Maintenance does not mean garbage man in that sense. It means maintaining the equipment in a recording studio.
This was decades before you could order this or that esoteric bit of audio gear from 1,000 online vendors. Al started with just one device made from printed circuit boards. It measured the rate of decay of sound at different frequencies. How long until bassy sounds die out? How long until high-pitched whining goes down? He'd shop it around at conventions, and folks were interested in using it, but they didn't know how to work it properly.
We don't know how to use it. We're not doing that. Could we hire you as a consultant to come in with your meter and measure our room? And I said, sure. What room is it? And he said, it's called Radio City Music Hall. I said, okay.
Al charged Radio City Music Hall all of $150, which, yeah, they got kind of a crazy bargain there. Al should have known better, but he's mostly self-taught and completely self-made. He says the information for how to build and use the tools of the trade were always out there if you had the interest to look.
That's pretty well. I always assumed like maybe like you went to school for engineering or something, but
well, I did. But I was at.
He did go to school for a while, but the introductory courses were too slow for him. He wanted to skip ahead to the advanced stuff.
Maybe I could just take the test. No, can't do it. So I took a leave of absence, which I'm still on.
Al's career may seem a somewhat nerdy one, but it wasn't always so. He used his audio know-how to start Sorcerer Sound, a recording studio he ran for nearly 30 years, closing shop in 2003 only after recording Norah Jones' Grammy-winning Come Away With Me. He tells me she bought the microphone she used off of him at auction.
I don't know why I didn't come. I left you by.
I ask him why walk away from all that, and he says, well, musicians keep weird hours, and the money's better here, measuring noise in people's apartments and businesses. It's a rather inscrutable part of Al, leaving the glamour of rock and roll for listening to bricks and wooden beams, but it's a part of him that starts to make more sense over breakfast. He orders a hot chocolate instead of a coffee, and I remember how he turned down an offer of fancy scotch from the musician earlier. He tells me he gets high on life and directs our conversation to these panels above us in the cafe.
See, those are the panels, and they come in different shapes. See how they have different edges, beveled or square.
And you said these are the bevel.
Yeah, you can see the bevel in some of them, a slight angle.
Yeah.
See the angle?
Oh, yeah. So what's that do?
Makes it look good.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Those panels, Al explains, are why we can have a conversation at normal volume, even in a packed cafe, even with music playing. They're the difference between the wall of noise that is a high school cafeteria and our pleasant chatter over lox and bagels. Al sees how sound and sound management make our lives better in all these little, seldom noticed ways.
It says 125, 250. Those are the frequencies.
Our next job is this bar slash grill slash concert venue that wants to open up in Lower Manhattan. The issue? It's built below and between a bunch of apartments. Al sets up his huge amp in the basement where concerts will one day take place, and we ride the elevator up and down, checking each floor. Periodically, Al takes out this tan plastic remote, one that he built himself. He'll point this remote in whatever direction he thinks leads to his speaker. Sometimes that means down the corner of an elevator, sometimes across a staircase. It sends a radio signal clear through the building to get the techno going. Other noise guys, Al tells me, would work in teams, with one texting the other to start the amp. But he says all that's a waste of time. And anyway, you'll lose cell service in here. His remote is just handier.
It does many things, too. I can turn on lights, I can turn on appliances, I can turn things on and off.
He shuts off the amp and takes a reading.
Apartment 2C, living room, sound coming through floor and walls, mostly floor.
We do this up and down the building. Check the buildings next door as well. How far can this music reach? Al's making all these readings to make all of these places more livable.
You have a lot of co-ops in New York City. Co-op is short for cooperative. They're supposed to be cooperative. Very often they're not.
On our walk to the next job, I asked Al, is there a type of call he likes better than the others? And he says, yeah, it's the calls where you get to help someone.
You get a neighbor who lives on the top floor in a co-op. They're right near the elevator motor room. Can be very noisy. But all the other members of the co-op who are not affected by this say, screw you. Not affecting me. It's only one person who's complaining. I heard that a lot. Oh, you're the only person complaining. So I guess you don't count.
To Al, all of you out there, sleepless and at your wit's end, you do count. I wonder how many well-rested New Yorkers have Al or someone like him to thank for their good night's sleep. Never knowing his readings and recommendations silenced a boiler unit or muffled a nightclub sound system.
I get a lot of calls from people on Sunday morning, Saturday morning, Monday morning, after a weekend of partying by the nearby neighbors. They can't sleep. They've spoken to the people about it. People feel you don't like it. Move out of the city, move to the country, get your own house.
If you've lived in a city and ever complained about noise, you've probably heard some version of this, like it's some cost of getting to live in the city.
Can I ask you, like, what do you say to those? We kind of talked about this before, but like, what do you say to those people who, like, when you complain about noise, they're like, yeah, what do you want? You're living in the city.
What do I say to those people?
Yeah.
The city has laws. If you don't want to be in a city in a place where there's laws, go private island. You get benefits from living in the city. Walk down the street and buy food so you don't have to grow it yourself. So that's the benefits you get. The price you pay is taxes and laws, and that includes consideration for other human beings.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slaman, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.